Hello and welcome to the third episode of Gamers Without Borders. I am Patrick Mifflin alongside Teresa Sammons, Kayla Owen, and Filippo D'Anolfo making an appearance on the show. We're going to be talking a lot about ethics and legality in emulation and ways to actually navigate the law tonight. But before we get started on that, Phil, you've been listening to the show. I just wanted to start talking about how this whole thing started, really, like with me getting into the retro minis and you kind of helping me out with the setup and getting back into emulation with the Alienware. But you kind of had a similar run in with Next Gen and kind of going back to exploring the retro side of things. How's that gone for you?
Well, it went a little sideways, honestly, because
Xbox wasn't
cooperating. Wasn't I have two Xboxes since, you know, I wanted to play some PGR2, like get the Xbox out, hook it up to the TV. That didn't work out so well because power on my modded Xbox and it doesn't power up. Just nothing. Just completely, utterly dead. So I get out my other non-modded Xbox and put the disc in, and that one starts up, making some very loud, angry noises. So it's like, yeah.
That's not good.
No. And pretty sure, unless whoever refurbished it the last time took out the clock capacitor, that thing is probably eating away at the motherboard. So I found a guy who's not too far away from me, and he does retro console repairs and mods. So I'm going to be sending those consoles over to him, and he's going to have a look and see what can be done. I'm really waiting on the Xbox Digital to be released, which is the HDMI mod for the original Xbox that will do upscaling to 1080p. There's already a PS1 digital for the PlayStation that does the same thing and actually looks really good. That's kind of been the weird thing about it. It's like Next Gen wasn't really doing much for me because there's not really any games I want to play right now. But,
there's hardly any games at all.
Yeah, well, I mean they're out there. It's just,
there's really not what I would say ninth generation games, though. It's eighth generation games running on ninth generation hardware.
Yeah. But you know, to be fair, when any console launches, it's usually that way. There's really never any like truly showcase games. Like for the PS4, there wasn't really a whole heck of a lot. For the Xbox One, same thing. It was just prettier versions of what you had seen in the seventh gen. So yeah, but you know, since I don't have anything like that going on, I'm just going back to the older stuff and finding out that hardware, even if you baby it and you try to take care of it, eventually does degrade.
Yep.
Fortunately.
Which is a big part of exactly what it is we're doing here.
Yeah. Because before we move forward, though, I kind of wanted to touch on a couple of things that you talked a little bit about on the last episode, where accessing Japanese games. You didn't mention, and you probably should have, well, it probably slipped your minds, but if you use Microsoft Bing Translate and Google Translate with your smartphones, just pointing it at the screen usually gives you a pretty decent translation. It's not perfect. Sometimes it messes up, but and it's not really great for fast subtitles that go by. But if you got like dialogue choices or stuff that stays on the screen for a while, you can do that.
I found out about that from you actually. So
yeah.
It's been useful, like in Final Fantasy 14. You know, you're with a party and they keep saying the same thing, and I'm like, I don't know what you mean. And then point the phone. Oh, okay, I get a general idea of what you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. But, and I mean, the entire point of of playing on the Japanese servers in Final Fantasy 14, or really, I do this on the American servers too, to be honest with you. I fake a language barrier so I don't have to interact. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. There's also, want to mention RetroArch, which, you know, we both like a lot.
Oh, yeah.
It has pretty recently, actually, a couple of releases ago, it implemented an AI machine learning feature, which you can hook up to, and it will on the fly translate a game as you're playing it.
Nice.
Hot yeah. Damn.
Yeah. It's not perfect, obviously, but yeah. Yeah.
In fact, that they're even getting started with it.
Yeah. So that might be something that would be worth looking into if you want to check out some older games that might not have fan translations or obscure enough that people haven't gotten around to them yet. So yeah, here you can check that out. It's not very difficult to set up. There's a pretty the documentation to set that up is less than a page, so not really hard to get into.
Oh, nice.
That's good to know.
Yeah. So yeah, that's pretty much all I wanted to touch on.
We also found out over the last week that the Xbox One is secretly a monster of an emulation box.
Yeah, we kind of did, didn't we? This is a feature that's actually been in the Xbox One since it was originally released. It relies on the dev mode that lets you basically just develop UWP apps, Universal Windows Platform. It doesn't give you full access to the hardware, but the access you have is enough to do some pretty good emulation as far as, RetroArch has got basically almost all of their cores running.
Nice.
So far. PSP runs great, N64. Depends on the game. That one's a little bit hit and miss. PS1, pretty much everything can emulate PS1 at this point. Saturn runs brilliantly. It's, because you're basically running it on a PC at that point, so it's good.
How high up does it go?
At this point, I think probably PSP is about as far as you can go. It will do Dreamcast, but PSP came out later.
We're not doing GameCube and PS2 just yet.
If you're running it on an Xbox Series S, yes.
Okay.
And that's the thing, because dev mode is also available in the Series S and Series X. So there's potential there. I'm kind of hoping that eventually Microsoft will update developer mode to allow for a little bit more access to the hardware. Because I'm pretty sure, given that the fact that they're abandoning the UWP platform and people are still using it, maybe Microsoft will be nice and put in some newer APIs that homebrew developers can have fun with. So there's that. Also, interestingly, this is news that came out recently, PCSX2. Is being ported into RetroArch.
Good.
So, yeah, very soon there will be very little reason to have anything else.
The point of it.
Yeah. The only thing that bothers me about that is, is it going to be as slow to develop as the standalone version, or maybe they're going to be a bit quicker? I don't know. So we'll have to wait and see.
That's definitely something only time will tell.
Yeah. But if you have an Xbox One X, or you can snag one on Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace for a pretty good price, it's something worth trying out. Or if you want to just dedicate an Xbox Series S to that task, that's even better.
$300.
I wouldn't spend $500 for a Series X just for that purpose.
No.
But I'll also point out that you can switch in and out of developer mode, at will. It's just a reboot. The only thing is, if you're in developer mode, you can't play retail games, and if you're in normal retail mode, you can't play any of the homebrew stuff. So it's it's a little bit of a barrier that Microsoft put in for, you know, so to avoid piracy, I guess. But, you know, it, at least you can develop your own apps and run them on the Xbox and, yeah, have fun with that. That's, yeah. Which is way more than I can say for what Sony's been doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Kayla, you got a hold of Game & Watch. How is it?
It's awesome. So I think the emulation on it is pretty close to being the same emulation on the Switch.
All right.
Which is pretty amazing considering how tiny and light it is. It's pretty incredible, and I would love to see, especially for kids, since this is a really like inexpensive gaming device, and it doesn't, you know, you don't need extra cartridges for it. This is a great thing for kids to be able to play classic games. And I really would love to see more, more publishers put their games out on little things like this.
Yeah.
My only suggestion is though, don't pay the $120 for it right now. I mean, it's definitely worth $50 if you buy it from somebody who's not a scalper. But
wait, they're, you know, scalping these?
Yeah, they're scalping everything these days.
Oh my God. Yeah, I did see that they already have Doom running on it, which of course they do.
Yeah, yeah. Reddit's been going a little crazy over over the Game & Watch these past, I guess, maybe 2 weeks now. They've been really just, every time I go on there, I'm like, oh my God, are we still talking about this? That's awesome. Because, you know, their attention span is very short, but but yeah, they're still going on about it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what other homebrew stuff they end up doing with that. It didn't seem like a device that they were going to really do a whole lot with, but if the emulation quality on board is good. At minimum, you've got an NES player, depending on what kind of storage it has on board. But even just for what it is, it's nice. So,
yeah. And just, it's just weird that like they put two games on there. So, you know, technically, you could probably put more in there.
Yeah.
Since they've already got Doom running on it, and it's like, yeah, if there's an accessible USB port and it has a data line, somebody's going to figure out how to get into that thing.
Yeah,
it's just pretty much inevitable.
Yeah, and it's and apparently there's enough space on it to put Doom, so yeah. Pretty good room for a number of NES games, if nothing else.
Yeah.
So, the main topic of the show this week is sort of the ethical and legal aspects of emulation, because like emulation is a big part of what we do just with modifying retro minis or SBCs or actual like computers, where a lot of it is emulation based. And so it's good that we're going to be able to take some time to really do a deep dive on how to stay above board in terms of emulation and using ROMs and ISOs legally and so on and so forth. Before we get into the legal side, I just want to take some time to discuss the ethical side of it. But let it be said, we are not lawyers. Nothing that you're about to hear on this episode is legal advice of any kind. We will be talking about the law, but we're going to be painting with a fairly broad brush and not really getting to not getting involved in the minutiae of it too much, because honestly, I don't know about anyone else on this panel. I don't actually know a lot about the minutiae of it, except for a couple things that we're going to talk about that directly involve like personal backups and what have you. But as far as the ethical side of emulation, there are a lot of good arguments for it. One of which being sampling games to play later. I know that I'm not the only one here who has discovered great games just by encountering some ROM out in the wild and then went on to purchase the game later on. How about you guys?
No, that's definitely happened for me.
Yeah.
Xenocrisis was one of those. I ended up pirating the ROM, trying it out. And yes, I said pirating. I'm not going to shy away from it because that's exactly what it is. But played it for a good while and realized I want this game. Figured out how am I going to get it legally. And turns out I could just go over to the Bitmap Bureau's website and I just bought the ROM.
Yep.
So
and they make it easy.
Yeah, I love that because
You can also get a physical copy if you wanted. So if you want to play it on a real Genesis, you could do that too. So,
and it's amazing that it's even a Genesis game because, I mean, I've said this before on the Day Zero update, but sitting down and playing it, I felt like I was playing a 32X game just because it looks and sounds so good.
Yeah.
So they definitely did a good job with that.
Yeah. Well, they got some very talented people that were on that project. So, yeah, it turned out really, really well. And, they're working on the Neo Geo version right now, so I'm not entirely sure how that's going to work with only four buttons. But
yeah, I do not want to play that on Neo Geo hardware.
Sure, it'll look better, but yeah.
I guess if you had a Neo Geo CD controller, that would solve half the problem, but
yeah,
there's another half there.
Yeah. Like a lack of two buttons.
Yeah. You got to have the roll and the grenades.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a thing. I've discovered some fantastic games just by searching ROMs and ISOs that maybe stuff that I wanted to play but never got around to picking up before, or stuff that I'd never even heard of before and just saw it on a site and it looked interesting and I ended up buying it. That was actually how I got into the Star Soldier series, which I'm a huge Star Soldier fan at this point. That series does not get its due at all. And more recently, the Battle Gear series on the PlayStation 2. That series, I'm hoping we somehow find a way to get our hands on Battle Gear 4 sometime, but because that game looks amazing. But just really good quality games that might have gotten under the radar before. It's a really great way to discover them and find new things to support rather than maybe the whole I've got nothing better to do, so I might as well pick up X, AAA game.
Yeah.
That seems to fuel much of the mainstream industry these days. Another plus I would say is circumventing a largely unethical aftermarket.
Oh my gosh, right? We talked about the $500.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The okay, Dragon Ball so GT.
We're going to out ourselves here. But
yeah.
But yeah. I mean,
but to be fair, I bought the game originally to play it. That was, it was an honest purchase. And then it just kind of took on a life of its own as I realized, A, the game was shit. But B, the IP took off in North America right around that time, and so people were shelling out absurd amounts of money for it. And it was just kind of a perfect scenario. But a lot of cases, you have people actively hoarding these games.
Yeah.
Not even to play them, but to just to either have them or to flip them for top dollar when the market decides it's a top dollar.
Yeah. I was a little concerned that was going to happen and probably still could happen with the physical copy of Mario All-Stars for Switch.
Oh, it will.
Yeah. And it's only available for a limited time. And when you hear that, it's like, what's coming. Mm-hmm.
you know, it's not going to be good. Well, and there's no call for that to be, you know, bought up later on at scalper prices.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it really comes down to availability.
Yeah.
If there's no other way to get it, that's what's going to happen is the prices are going to go up. In the case of Mario All-Stars, the physical version is going to be it's a limited run, but you'll still be able to buy it on the eShop. So,
well, no, they're going to be pulling it from that too, aren't they?
They will. Yeah, that's what that was my understanding was. Yeah, that it's like a 6-month thing only.
Okay, so they're just being assholes about it.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
I'm not getting the strategy here with that, because the only thing that it's going to do is
drive prices up.
Yeah.
And it's not like Nintendo's going to be the ones to benefit.
No.
And that's the other part of the unethical aftermarket. Like, a lot of these games that I discover and then want to go and buy later, I would love to support the developers, the publishers who made all this possible, and, you know, put some of my money in their pocket for making a game that I genuinely want to play. If it's some schmuck reseller on eBay or Amazon, fuck them.
Yeah.
I don't care if they are losing money from emulation or piracy. I want to support the developers.
Yeah. And just saying, it's like, this isn't the case for every game though, because it's like, if you're looking for stuff like, you know, it's like Battle Gear 2, Battle Gear 3, you can find those pretty easily.
And
they're not hugely expensive. Yeah. It's certain titles that, you know, get a reputation, and then the prices go skyrocketing through the roof.
And the PS2 is suffering a rash of that right now.
Yes.
Really? What's going on with that?
Demand for games are trending upward again, and everyone who has the games wants to keep them.
Yeah. And there's also a younger generation of gamers who are discovering that the PS2 is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So.
Hmm. And the games have aged really well for the most part.
Yeah, a lot of them have.
Bummer. But another thing that's kind of attached to that subject is we are coming face to face with an issue called disc rot. And Kayla, this is something that you've definitely been a major awareness advocate of. You want to get us started on this issue?
So I remember it's a little different for each format, but basically all optical media can suffer from disc rot, whether it's CDs or Laserdiscs or even early DVDs, and of course video games. And for some games that I've encountered and had disc rot, like my copy of Street Fighter Collection on the Saturn, it doesn't play the music anymore. And that's not really that big of a deal if the game still works, because I can just put my headphones on and play.
Yeah.
But some games just will not work anymore. And you'll see that on eBay a lot. They'll sell a game and they'll say it just does not work because of disc rot. Now, disc rot sometimes is visible. Sometimes it will look like oxidation on the bottom of the disc. Like it will, it won't have that gold or blue color anymore in certain places. Or sometimes it'll be like more like it will look physically damaged.
Yeah.
So it's really something you have to be careful of when you're buying disc-based games. If you like to collect for Saturn or Sega CD, that just some of these games just can't work anymore, or they work, but there's going to be some problems.
Yeah, there's definitely going to be a situation in the not so distant future where people are buying defective games just to have the license, I think, to stay above board for emulation purposes. And it's something the industry is going to have to contend with sooner than later, because these are not games that we should be losing. And thankfully, there's enough of an emulation scene out there that we can already say that they're pretty safely archived. But now it's just a matter of keeping people able to play those games, which again comes back to the original concept of the show, continuing to access as much of your investment as possible. Oh, just a moment. Lee's back on. So, Lee, you've got a PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X now. How did that turn out?
I do. So I have had the overall experience with the Xbox has been, I don't know, I guess simple. It just feels like a very souped up Xbox One X. And part of that is because Microsoft, I think it was about, I want to say it was about a month ago, pushed out like their store update and to just everyone's Xbox hardware. So what you see, like if you have an Xbox now, it's going to look the exact same on the Xbox Series X. It's just going to be faster. And like speaking of fast, both of the systems are insanely fast. I had a couple of different varying experiences though between the two. Like the first one was the only hiccup I had with the Xbox was I took hard drives that I had plugged into my two Xbox One X's. And then I hooked up my Series X. God, they've got to do something about these names. I mean, just it's terrible. But anyway, so I was hooking up my sex box, the big monolithic long black sex box. And I just literally plugged in the old hard drives. And something weird that I encountered was, and I don't know if you can do this on the other hardware because I just never experienced it. I ended up swapping a couple of different hard drives and kind of moving them around. So I took one from upstairs, or excuse me, took one from downstairs and put it upstairs. And what I noticed is I would try to launch some of the games and it would say, you know, hold on, we're getting your game ready. And then there would be an update, right? So that was to be expected. Yeah. What I didn't expect to happen, and it happened to me on both systems, was in a couple of instances, it downloaded the games that I already owned that I had selected to play. It downloaded them twice. So I would have a version of it on the internal memory and I would have a version of it on my external hard drive. So that ended up causing me, you know, it took about 20 minutes to actually comb through all of the externals that I have to make sure I didn't have a game somewhere twice.
Yeah.
And I found out halfway through doing that, the easiest way to do that is to actually go to the game itself, hit whatever's supposed to be the start button, which is like the right click now, if it was a mouse. And then you just like examine the game and like it's downloaded. You do like manage a game and downloads, and then it'll actually tell you if it's installed somewhere twice. And so from there you can go in and just delete it. But it's still very strange to have that happen.
Yeah.
So I think what that would end up doing is I think it'll create a situation for some people where they may just think they're running out of memory and they really aren't. The other thing that I think is weird, and I hope that Microsoft addresses, is that, and it is not a bug, but what happens is if you download a game, right, on the Series X, and it will, and you, let's say you download it to your external, right? If it will run better on the internal memory, there, it'll put a little icon in the corner of the art, and there'll be an arrow going to the left, and then right below it, there'll be an arrow going to the right, and that's supposed to stand for this will run better from the internal hard drive. And then also in the left-hand corner, you'll see an X and an S to say that it's, you know, enhanced for the Xbox Series, whatever the fuck. So, but again, they don't make that clear that that's what that means. The other thing that I think can add confusion for a couple of folks, and it certainly did for us at the beginning, was you can still set your default install location, right? Now, unlike the PlayStation 5, and I'll talk about the PlayStation 5 in just a second. And when you have an external hard drive hooked up to the PlayStation 5, you can tell it specifically, there's a toggle that says download all PlayStation 4 games to this external hard drive. And so then that, and that's really important on the PlayStation 5 because the PlayStation 5 has a laughable amount of memory out of the box.
Yeah, really want to preserve that that solid state drive.
Yeah, and the it says 825 gigs on the box, but you end up with about 605 after the OS is installed and after Astro's Playroom. Yeah. Whereas with the Xbox says it's a terabyte, And I think after everything's installed, you end up with right around 825 gigs. So what Sony's advertising, you end up with on the Xbox, and the Xbox is advertising a terabyte, and you end up with 825 gigs. Both of them, regardless, though, are blazing fast. But I do hope that Microsoft at some point, you know, if you're downloading something, that will just simply run better off of the internal hard drive and really take advantage of the SSD speed, that it would tell you. Like, it would say, you should really put this here, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas you're able to move PlayStation 5 games to my external hard drive.
That's not happening.
I think, which is absolutely ridiculous, because you'd want to at least have that for, you know, so to speak, like cold storage.
Okay.
Yeah, and D-pad. The D-pad is great. It takes sort of like that disc that they used for the Elite controller, and it raises the edges and then recesses the diagonals a bit. I really like it. It's really clicky. Because the problem I had with the old D-pad is, since it just simply wasn't raised enough, I found myself putting a lot of force on it, and it always ended up making my hands sore. And then now, like, you compare that to the what are they calling it? The DualSense? Or it's a DualShock 5. So the DualSense is cool, but I think it's extremely, at least right now, I think it's extremely overrated. Like, these people that are like, oh, I've never experienced anything like this, I think they should get out more. Because the only thing that actually makes it really feel cool is Astro's Playroom. But I would argue that it feels like Astro's Playroom was designed specifically to be a showcase for what the controller can do as far as the haptics. But like, in playing Miles, with the exception of like the opening scene, like where you feel the subway tracks, because it opens up and you're on a subway car, it's just vibration, you know, like it, and the triggers being adjusting their tension. I don't know if I'm just heavy handed. I could feel it, but it didn't feel like a game changer. And I think also too, with just the haptics in general, if you're in the middle of like fighting something or you're really focused on the game, you're not really paying attention to that feedback. At least I don't. So I'm really curious to see what everybody, you know, does in the future, developers do in the future with the controller. But it was all of the stuff that I had read felt really just hyped up. And it just felt like people being excited, because I think realistically, and I'm not trying to be a dick here, the controller might be the only thing to really get excited about the PlayStation with. Miles Morales was great. I already beat it. I'll probably play Demon's Souls. But other than that, I mean, there's not a lot there. And the Xbox, you can argue, is even worse, because, you know, they didn't even launch with Halo. Like, basically all of their stuff is third party. That's not even going to be, exclusive to them for long. Like, I think Yakuza is going to be able to come out on the PlayStation 5 in March, I think it is. And so I think their biggest, you know, system seller, so to speak, is Assassin's Creed, which I haven't even played. So, I mean, it feels like for both of them, they should have waited 6 months.
Yeah.
In my opinion, like, these should have just, Sony's, you know, hardware is great. The Xbox Series X hardware is great. But Sony's software is not where it needs to be. There's a lot of glitches, and there's some weird design choices done with the UX as well that I'm sure that we'll get used to. But it really felt like Sony is really taking on the idea of, like, this is a new generation. And I normally am all about that kind of shit, but now that I'm actually in software development, and just from, you know, playing games so long that I have to constantly reinvent themselves over and over again, sometimes you don't have to reinvent the wheel. And that's one of the things I got to give Microsoft credit for, is because what they have, it just works. Besides that issue with the games downloading twice, I didn't encounter anything that was nearly as frustrating as trying to download a game I own and to have the PlayStation 5 throw up an error. The other thing too is, I had the PlayStation 5 crash 5 times on me, like to a black screen, where I even thought like maybe my PS5 had bricked. Like, if you check Reddit, like, there are people that have had their consoles bricked. And so they have all of these random ass rules for what you shouldn't do. You shouldn't put the system in rest mode. You shouldn't have an external drive plugged in. You shouldn't charge the DualSense through the front USB port. You should just charge it, you know, from the wall. Like, there's all of these different things that people are doing because they don't want to accidentally brick their $500 new console. Like, we shouldn't be doing that now. You know,
no, burden on the users. That's right.
And it's so interesting too, because especially, of course, you see that in like a PlayStation subreddit. So a lot of people aren't mad because they're in that subreddit in the first place because they're PlayStation fans, you know? So, but yeah, I mean, the bottom line is I feel like neither one of these should have really come out. And the thing is, I say that for two different reasons. I feel like Xbox did not have, or Microsoft did not have a real reason to launch this console, except that Sony launched theirs. And Sony, it feels like to me, should not have launched this, because I would argue they needed a stronger launch lineup. Even as good as Miles is, it is a short game. I think it ends up being about 12 hours and maybe 15 if you do everything.
Which and it's actually on PS4.
Yeah, and it's on PS4. And the thing is, I looked at the PlayStation 4 version. The ray tracing, don't get me wrong, looks fantastic. Especially there's a certain subtleness to a lot of the ray traced elements that happen in the game that are just really neat to see. But even when you remove that, it runs fantastic on the PlayStation 4. There are, you know, some graphical differences, but they are all really minor. So yeah, it just feels like, again, you know, Microsoft brought out the Xbox because Sony was bringing out the PlayStation 5. And it feels like Sony was bringing out the PlayStation 5 because they were like, fuck it. We already, you know, we set a date and we already put all this hardware out. And you know, to their credit, I mean, both systems don't seem to be staying on the shelves. So people are obviously buying them and we're ready for a next generation. But I could not in any way, shape, or form in good conscience recommend anyone buy these unless they absolutely have to either, if you're one of my PlayStation 5, you absolutely want to play Demon's Souls or Miles, you know, and in Miles' case, it's going to be, you know, with just a smidge higher fidelity or the performance mode to do 60 frames a second. And with the Xbox, the only reason that I would even suggest buying this is that if you have a bunch of backwards compatible games that you want to play, that would be the reason. But there's certainly no new game reason to buy the Xbox One. And then the last thing I will say, though, I think the strength of both of them right now is all of the games that I have messed around with the Xbox, it's not that big of a deal because the backwards compatibility we expect. But I got to hand it to Sony, the backwards compatibility that they added in for the PlayStation 4, from everything I've seen so far, is actually really nice. And on some games that have things like uncapped frame rates, they're hitting 60 frames a second for the most part, which is a really nice thing to have happen. So, you know, if you want to play your BC titles, you know, your backwards compatible titles, you know, at a higher frame rate on both the Xbox One or the PlayStation 5, and you have a big enough backlog, that might be a reason to jump in, but it's certainly not for the new games. And I would argue, you know, the new features, like the hard drives are really fast and it's really impressive. But again, it just kind of comes down to what's important for you.
Yeah.
So wait. Certainly don't be a fucking scalper.
No.
Yeah, wait.
Yeah.
They'll make more, trust me.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the thing that's blown my mind is that the way that the PlayStation accessories can't stay on the shelves. Like, Wario 64 was sending out links every time, like, the remote comes back in stock or the charging cradle comes back in stock. And then they just disappear, like, 5 seconds later. Which is, again, it's something else I got to give Microsoft credit for. I just plugged in my Series X and linked my controllers. I didn't have to do shit, you know, even just getting like, and that's the last thing. And I'm sorry, I don't want to take up the rest of the time. You can use a DualShock 4 on a PlayStation 5, but you can only use it for PlayStation 4 games. That actually ended up being good for me because one of the things that I've complained about in the past is I have to use the back button attachment for most everything because my right hand is messed up, my index finger is. So at least being able to play my backwards compatible titles, I can just use the PlayStation. I can use the DualShock 4, which I have my back button attachment on. So that is nice. But again, it's just one of those things with the haptics where I'm like, man, that's not a good enough reason not to let people use the damn PlayStation 4 controller. Like, it's really not. So anyway, that's it. Don't buy them. Wait till summer or when, you know, something comes out that you legitimately want to play. I just can't imagine wasting $500 on each of the systems now, because there's just not much to do on any of them. And Sony has at least, you know, Miles and has Demon Souls, but the Xbox ain't got shit.
Yeah. So, moving on to something that I was going to touch on before we go to the legal side of the emulation issue. I've kind of idealized a marketplace along the lines of GOG, where you know, publishers will just dump non-proprietary ROMs out there for people to buy at set prices and with account-based protection, and they can download it, they can run it on any way they want to, whether it's on a modified version of the original hardware or an emulator or something else for, you know, whatever use they might have. And for older games, that would, like, any money that they made off of that would be like finding a 20 in your jacket. Like, they're not making any money off of these anyway. So just put them out there, make it convenient, make it safe, so you don't have to go into some really sketchy site to get your ROM or ISO of the game. And there is a very viable market to be had there. I've heard enough about the game industry to know that it would be a really tough sell for most publishers. But I think if there was some way to get a couple of big publishers in there to start off, then it would probably gain a lot of traction, because there's demand for these games and all this stuff, the you know, the curated lists of backward compatible titles or the licensing deals, they're all in the way. And obviously, piracy is the more direct solution to that problem. But it's like I said earlier, I want to give these developers and these publishers my money to support games that I actually want to play. And so I would love to see a service like this crop up where they're just saying, okay, if someone wants to pay $5 to download an NES ROM, then we'll make that possible. And, you know, it would require a lot of understanding between the end users and the gaming industry at large. But I think if there was some kind of way to mediate that, then there's a lot of potential for that kind of service.
Yep.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll stop falling over themselves, you know, to not make that happen. Like, one of the things that I'm really curious about, Microsoft and what they're going to do in the future is they feel like they're already starting to go that way. You know, like, you just buy this box and we're going to have a storefront where you can buy all of this shit. And one of the interesting things about the Xbox Series in general is they have access to the APIs for enhancing the games. So they don't even need to go to the publishers to enhance them. They can do it themselves. And that is extremely interesting to me. So it's really just a matter of, you know, getting permission from the developers. Like, can we put your thing back on the store? Or can we do it in a way? Can we create, you know, some sort of emulator that we could use? You know, I'd be real curious to see how that works in the future, because I'm sure you guys have probably discussed it. The dev mode on the Xbox Series consoles, you can run emulators on, and it's a beast. So that feels like one step removed. And the thing is, they're not going to cut that off because that's just how they have it baked in. And I think Microsoft specifically addressed people wanting to break open their system by going, here, we'll just give you the keys, but we're just not going to let you run anything on it. not anything you want. You know, we can, if something is developed with UWP, then it'll run on this thing. You can, guys can go have fun with it. So, whereas you look at, like, you know, Sony and Nintendo are doing everything they can to lock their hardware down. So yeah, consumers can't do that very thing that you're talking about. And it is ironic that I that's one of the things that's always been so boneheaded to me about Sony. It seems like every suit that they get in there does not seem to understand the catalog they're sitting on. And since Sony is not providing a legitimate way for these people to play some of these things, except to break out, you know, 15-year-old hardware, well, then people are just going to start stealing shit, you know, or running it on a PC. So, I mean, I'm hopeful, you know, hopefully that attitude will change at some point, but I kind of feel like it won't, at least in regards to Sony, and probably not Nintendo either.
No.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just had to get that out because I really feel strongly about that one, because I think it's something that there's a lot of untapped potential in. And if you could get, one or two big publishers behind it, I think then you'd start seeing them just start piling on. Yeah. But you just have to have those initial supporters to make it happen.
Yep.
So moving from the ethical side of emulation, now we get to talk about the legal side. And one, like, the common misconception is that emulation is illegal as a sweeping statement. That is not the case. There's also a belief that if you own the game, you can use the ROM, which is a lot closer to the truth, but there is some nuance to it in that technically you're supposed to be using backups that you yourself created.
Yeah.
And now that's not necessarily how it's always done in practice, but because that's a very difficult aspect of the law to enforce. But if you're looking to really just go full letter of the law above board, we've actually got Phil here to talk about how to do that. So I will defer to you.
All right. So there are actually several ways to do this, and it really depends on the console. We'll start with the disk-based ones, because those are pretty much the most straightforward. Basically, all you really need for those is a PC. You know, PC and a software like IMGBurn, put your disk in, read an ISO, job done. If you want an archival copy of that and you want to make sure it's perfect, there's software that the community's written, like Redump, which will do as close to a bit perfect copy of the disk as it can manage. In practice, you know, that doesn't really affect too much, but if you want to go that far, you can. There are some consoles, though, with the, like, the Dreamcast, the Wii, the GameCube, Xbox 360, Xbox, yeah, that are a little bit more difficult to do. Dreamcast, because of its drive, is probably the most difficult, since you need a broadband adapter and a whole lot of patience. Because you will need to load up a piece of software on the Dreamcast, then switch to your disk, connect that via network to your PC, and then stream the contents of the disk to the network, over the network to, yeah, your computer. So it takes a while. You could also do this over the modem on the Dreamcast if you are an insane person.
I was going to say a masochist.
Yes. So don't do that. So in practice, it's very difficult to dump your own Dreamcast ROMs. It can be done. If you want to put in the effort to do it, you can do it. But realistically, kind of your own option, your best option is just downloading them from people who already have dumped them. So that's kind of iffy, but that's where we are as far as Dreamcast goes, just because of the way the drive works.
I can imagine what that's done to the market on broadband adapters too.
Yes. If you have one, you're sitting on a gold mine. So other than that, GameCube and Wii are pretty straightforward. You can do those on a computer. Again, you need a redump to do that, and you need a very specific drive. Basically, the older your DVD drive is, the better chance you have of actually getting a good read on a GameCube or Wii game. Don't know why. That's just how it is. The more practical way of doing it, though, is with a homebrew-enabled Wii. With that, you'll be able to run a software called CleanRip on your Wii. Put the disk in, and it will dump the ISO of the game to your SD card. And that's, you know, that's about as straightforward as you can get for
that's
that.
That's more practical.
That yeah. Wii U is pretty much the same thing. Those you can read on a PC, but you need a Blu-ray drive to do it. Xbox and Xbox 360, those are a pain in the ass because of the way their partitions are set up. Only the first one is visible. So if you put a regular Xbox game or an Xbox 360 game into your PC, it's going to look like a DVD movie. It's not going to see that second partition where the Xbox data is. If you have, like I said, a very, very specific old DVD drive, you can rip those with a PC and a very custom firmware for that drive. Those are actually still pretty cheap on eBay. You can still get them. But as far as a more practical way of getting those particular games, you're best off with a modded Xbox and just putting the disc in and dumping it that way and then FTPing it out to your computer. 360, modded 360 is better because you can, again, do ISO rips from the console itself. Yeah, and that's pretty much it as far as disc-based games go. PS3, yeah, I'm not going to really get into that one because that involves some custom firmware for the PS3, basically, is what that boils down to. You can read a Blu-ray disc from a PS3 on a computer, but yeah, it doesn't always work out well. So sometimes you'll only get a single partition. Sometimes you'll get the whole thing. So it's really easier just to mod the PS3 and dump the game that way. So
that's probably why PS3 images are so hard to come by.
Yeah. Yeah. So, there's been that. Apart from that, we'll get into the cartridge based ones. And this is the trickier area because you are dealing with, you know, ROM chips and people don't have the equipment to really, read those in the, just lying around the house. It's just not something people typically have. But this stuff does exist for cartridge-based games. If you want to dump those yourself, there's a couple of devices. One of them's called the Retrode. It hooks up via USB, and it's just basically a cartridge port, and there's software you run on your Windows, Mac, or whatever PC what you have. You tell it what kind of system that cartridge is, and it reads it and gives you the ROM file. There are headers for pretty much every cartridge-based system at this point. There is a Nintendo 64-specific cartridge dumper that came out, I think, last year. But, the Retrode will do it with the N64 header. So the only trouble with the Retrode is finding them.
Because the guy behind it stopped making them, right?
Yeah, they're still being made. He's not making them, but... Yeah, there's a company in Germany that's manufacturing them now, but they do small batches. So it's like, yeah, they come into stock and then they go away. And then they come into stock and then they go away. But it's usually pretty steady. Every couple of months, they'll come in. So if you're patient and you set your notifications over at Stone Age Gamer or DragonBox.de, Should be able to get one. Not too difficult. If you're impatient and handy with soldering iron and maybe a 3D printer, if you want to make it look pretty, you could build your own Sani cart reader, which is basically very similar to a Retrode. It's just you build it on top of an Arduino Mega, and you can just read your cartridges that way. All the software is there on GitHub. The plans are there. So it's like, yeah, if you want a weekend project, you could build one of those. So, yeah.
That sounds like several weekends to me.
Yeah. No, first you need the weekend project to figure out how the hell you solder, because it doesn't really take that long to learn how to do that. It's just once you need some practice on technique on how to avoid melting things that you shouldn't be melting and melt things that you intend to melt. So there's that. But yeah, the options are out there for reading this stuff. So don't let people tell you that it's not possible, because obviously the fact that you can Google any system name and then ROMs and find a whole bunch kind of puts lie to that fact.
Yep.
So yeah. So it is possible to do. It's if you want to do it. Yeah, go ahead and do it. Another way that I will mention that some people forget about is retro gaming compilations oftentimes come with the ROMs.
This is true.
Yeah. For instance, the Sega Genesis collection over on Steam has all of the ROM files there in a directory, so you can just grab those. The GOG and Steam Neo Geo games have the ROMs in there. You can get those. If there's a retro game compilation that's come out, chances are you can probably grab ROMs out of those, and that is totally fine for you to do. So I'm not going to specifically go into every single compilation and how to find them, but
oh god, no,
yeah. it's pretty straightforward. You just have to poke around the directory, and you know, you usually find there's either a directory called ROMs or there's a data archive that you just uncompress, and you'll usually find the ROM folder in there. So, that's kind of it. It's not as difficult as a lot of people seem to think it is, but it's just knowing where to start. That's hopefully I've put you in the right direction.
Yep. That's the point of the episode.
Yep. So, yeah.
So with that, I think we've got a show.
Yeah. I hate you, Craig.
Yeah. Our recording software was definitely not cooperative tonight, but I should be able to splice together the pieces of episode that we've got here. So you can subscribe to us on anchor.fm or many other places at this point, Pocket Cast, Spotify, Breaker. We're not on iTunes yet, but I think that's just a matter of time. We've also opened up a Patreon page so that if you want to support the show more directly, you have that option. We also included an option where you can suggest segments for us to cover on a monthly basis. So if there's anything that you want us to talk about on the show, that is definitely a way to bring it up. In addition to that, you can email us at thegamerswithoutborders@gmail.com. Once again, that is thegamerswithoutborders@gmail.com. With Teresa Sammons, Kayla Owen, Lee Lamb, and Filippo Dinolfo, I've been Patrick Mifflin, and we will see you next time.